This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Darren Zammit-Lupi dreamed of being a photojournalist as he was growing up in Malta. He thought he'd have to leave the island nation in the Mediterranean to capture the kinds of stories that he was interested in. And then refugees began making desperate and dangerous attempts to reach Europe. And suddenly, one of the world's most compelling stories was sailing right past his home. Darren started documenting the crisis as it gained intensity. Nearly 14,000 migrants have died in the Mediterranean since 2014. That's according to an international organization for migration. And though international attention these days flows and waxes and wanes, quite frankly, Darren has found that the more he photographed, the more involved he became in these refugee stories and lives. Some of Darren's recent work is now on display at Duke University's Perkins Library. He's been meeting with students there this week, and he joins me in the studio now to tell us more about his work. Darren, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You were, I'm wondering about your desire, first of all, to become a photojournalist growing up in Malta. How long had that been with you?
It started off when I was just a young kid. Like many other sort of photographers, I was very heavily influenced by National Geographic. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was a subscriber since the late 70s, I think. And so I was brought up on a staple diet of National Geographics. And yeah, I just felt, you know, it would be wonderful to go out into the world and experience these things for myself. And as you said, you know, I wanted to travel around the world, you know, documenting these incredible stories. But, you know, the biggest story in Europe basically landed on my own doorstep. And
where were you in your career when the refugee crisis began to grow?
It's when it started picking up. I was just a local newspaper photographer. I just started doing a bit of stringer work for Reuters, the news agency. But my first exposure to the migration crisis was it was just another job I would do, you know, amongst like a dozen other shoots I'd have on a particular day. But I remember being really struck when some 50 migrants from Sierra Leone were brought to Malta on a Russian ship. I remember this was December 98, and you know, I went down there, I took my pictures and we published them. I scanned some files, sent them to Reuters, and the following morning I was watching foreign TV, you know, Italian television, and they had a newspaper review, and my picture was on the front pages of all the papers in Italy. And it really struck me there and then that it's like, oh my goodness, this is quite a big story. So, you know, the world is interested in this thing. And, you know, I became quite interested in following what was happening with migrants after that. It wasn't until 2003, 2004 that I started to go into it in a more in-depth fashion.
Well, let's talk about that. There was a transition from a kind of professional interest in a story that was big, and any good reporter would say, yeah, put me on the big story as, yeah, kind of a professional consideration, but it started to become very personal and very deep for you.
It did, because, you know, once I started spending some sort of time out at sea on rescue missions with the Maltese military and then meetings of migrants, not in detention camps at that time because they were off limits in the early noughties, but you know, just by being able to talk to people and so on, and learning their stories and learning the horrors that they were escaping from, I could not get personally involved. And as time went by, I started to kind of take you know, apart from the professional journalistic approach to things, I also felt, you know, I was slowly turning into an advocate for their rights.
What does that do to you professionally, and what does it do to you as a journalist as you now go to the story and feel yourself more personally drawn?
Yeah, I think that helps. I mean, you know, there is this misconception that the journalist always has to keep himself detached and, you know, totally objective and neutral. But in certain situations, I think you cannot do that because, you know, we're talking about human life here, about the sanctity of human life. And these guys are, you know, these, you know, men, women, and children, they are human beings just like you and I are. And the reason that they are fleeing across borders and we're not is simply an accident of birth and an accident of geography.
How, and you've also talked about what you've learned in terms of the hierarchies that are created in the world of migrants, and how their safety is dependent on whatever wealth they may have had at the beginning of their journey. And describe for us kind of what that means on a day-to-day basis, or in terms of the kind of boat you may find yourself on, and where you'll be in that boat.
Yeah, basically how it works out with the smugglers is. Nowadays, the migrants use two types of boats primarily. It's either sort of rubber dinghies, which are very unsafe because they're sort of single-tube dinghies, so one little puncture anywhere in the tube and the thing goes down. But they're relatively stable on the water unless it's very, very rough. Or unless, you know, people sort of... You know, these rubber dinghies get so heavily packed that if... And you'd have, like, rows of people sort of straddling the tubes, apart from those inside.
Right.
So if one person loses their balance and goes in, you've got a domino effect, and suddenly you've got plenty of people in the water. The latest incident of this sort was just yesterday. You know, just before coming in here, I was seeing a tweet from MSF, and they had a very routine operation taking place, and suddenly everybody from this rubber dinghy was in the water because one guy lost his balance. Everybody went in. Untold number of people have died, you know, in the past 24 hours.
MSF, there's Doctors Without Borders.
Yeah. They're operating off the Libyan coast on a ship called the Aquarius. So, and the other type of boats are these large wooden boats. These wooden boats are usually fishing boats. So, you know, one day it's owned by a fisherman and then he'll sell it to the smugglers and it becomes a smuggling boat. So, you know, even there, so if the EU had talked about, you know, destroying the smugglers' fleets. You can't do that because you can't tell the difference between a fishing boat and a smuggler's boat because they change hands from day to day. And what used to happen when I first went out on missions and I saw these boats, they would carry about 200 people on them and they looked really packed, you know, 200 people. Yeah. Nowadays, those same boats could carry like 600, 700, 800 people. And what you have is you normally have two or three tiers. It's almost like, you know, third, second, and first class. Up top, you've got the people who can sort of pay the most money. They usually, you know, the Syrians, for example, they're the guys who tend to escape with lots of money in their hands because they come from, you know, well-to-do families and they've had, you know, pretty normal lives until the war broke out. And also, you know, the more money you have, the quicker you can get a place on the boat. So the more you can pay, the better place you get. So you go on top of the boat, outside, and that's the safest place, usually up on the sort of superstructure of the boat. Then you've got the second tier, those are down on the deck. They would pay a bit less money. It's still, you know, safe within reason, but they're pretty tightly packed. And then you've got the third class, which is usually the sub-Saharan Africans, who are crammed inside the hold. They're like, no, they can't move. They're crammed so tightly inside. And there's only one exit on those boats, usually. Sometimes two. A little hatch, maybe 2.5 by 2.5 feet. So if the boat capsizes or anything goes wrong, you've got 300-400 people all trying to get out through this narrow space, which is basically impossible. It's only the few people right by the exit point who might stand a chance of getting out. Then, you know, once you factor in all the panic that's going to break out and so on, you know, these people don't stand a chance. You know, the worst shipwreck we had in the Mediterranean was in April of 2015, and up to 900 people are believed to have died in that shipwreck. You know, I clearly remember the day that it happened because, you know, it was obviously, we were trying to get all sorts of information. The following day, an Italian Coast Guard ship came to Malta to offload the corpses they had recovered. There were only, I believe it was 21 bodies. They only recovered 21 bodies, and they had 28 survivors on board, and they took those to Italy. Some 900 bodies remained, you know, in the water, and most of them were inside the hull of this boat. And it was more than a year later that the Italians sent divers down and brought the bodies up one by one. This was one of the worst maritime disasters in the Mediterranean. I was going to say since the Second World War, but you know, the Second World War, would you classify a ship going down during the war as a disaster? You know, no. There is a slight sort of subtle difference over there. And, you know, this brings me to a point which I like raising, because you know, many people sort of don't see the connection and they think I'm not quite, comparing like with like. But April 1912, the Titanic went down. 1,517 people died that day. And we still talk about it. You know, 105 years later, we commemorate the anniversary on the 12th of April. You know, it's a huge thing in our sort of collective consciousness, you know, mm-hmm. the sinking of the Titanic. And yeah, every year you've got, you know, 2-3 times the number of people dying in the Mediterranean. And I'm generalizing here when I say nobody thinks about it and nobody cares about it, nobody talks about it. But by and large, people don't really care. And that really, really bothers me.
Well, when they think about it, they think about ways in general. If we're taking a look at the politics these days in the United States of America and in Europe, yeah. It does seem that when they think about it at all, it's thinking about ways to keep them out.
Yeah.
Well, what do you make of that, of the international response to this worldwide global crisis?
It's I think it's the wrong approach. I mean, I sometimes, you know, and, no, this is obviously strictly my personal opinion and not that of my employers. But it's, you have a situation here where human beings are trying to flee horrors, the likes of which we in the West can't even begin to imagine. Living in Eritrea under that current dictatorship is, you know, we can't conceive what it's like. People coming out of Somalia, Sudan, Darfur, northern Nigeria, where Boko Haram are active, and so on. Yes, you do have people who make the journey from Central Africa for economic reasons. So they cross the Sahara, which is an extremely dangerous thing to do. Let's not forget that, you know, before they cross the Mediterranean Sea, they've got to cross the Sea of the Sahara. And we don't know how many people are dying in the desert. We know there are many because the migrants always talk about we lost so many people on the way. But, you know, the bodies are covered by the shifting sands within hours. Mm. So you're never going to find them. We're never going to be able to quantify how many people are out there. Even with the economic migrants, once they get to Libya, they are so ruthlessly exploited. They live a life of slavery. We have modern day slavery in Libya today. Libya is a failed state. You know, we all know that it's run by two rival governments and countless militias, all vying for supremacy. And the migrants, you know, especially the sub-Saharans, are seen as a commercial commodity to be sold between one militia and the other. They're tortured. Women are raped several times a day. So even if a guy fled from his home as an economic migrant, once he has come to Libya, he's not in a safe place and he has no choice but to flee again. And he's got a choice. He could either flee north, get on a boat and head up to Europe, or try to cross the Sahara to go back home. And from interviews which are coming out, it seems that they consider crossing the Sahara a lot more dangerous than getting on a boat.
You know, you've covered this story for a long time, and obviously you're passionate about it. But you've also noticed this kind of unintended consequences of the coverage. You did one photograph in particular that gave you pause, that became widespread.
Yeah. This was, it's almost funny when I think about it. And it is a story with a happy ending, which makes a lovely change. This was a... October 2013, there were two shipwrecks off Lampedusa, huge loss of life. And most of the survivors from the second shipwreck were brought to Malta. Amongst them, there was this 10-year-old Palestinian Syrian kid. He caught my eye as he was disembarking. He got on, and I took his portrait as he was on this police bus. And people were struck by the picture because, you know, blue eyes, blonde hair, fair skin. You know, he looked different from what some people normally see. And, you know, in time, I got to know the family and all that. And a year later, they were leaving Malta to be relocated to Germany. And they told me that Hamad's father and elder brother, who had also been rescued, had just spent a couple of months in prison. And I was horrified. And I kind of said, like, why? And they said, we were leaving Malta a few months ago with false documents. And somebody recognized Hamad because of your picture. And so the police came over, figured these were false documents, you know, prison for dad and big brother. And I was mortified. But then they started laughing about it because they felt, you know, now a few months later, everything's okay. We have genuine documents. So now we can safely go to Germany and we won't spend the rest of our lives looking over our shoulders, hoping not to get caught by
the authorities. In the meantime, there had been an outpouring of support for the family because of the picture.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
they,
yeah, absolutely.
They received a lot
absolutely.
Of...
yeah, people helped dad find a job. Hamad was given a free schooling in a very expensive private school. My daughter goes to the same school, so it was lovely seeing him engage with students and integrate and grow within the school community. They helped them find an apartment. It was lovely. And I'm still in touch with the family now, like, you know, 4 years later, and is doing really, really well in Germany.
Darren Zemet-Lupi is an award-winning photojournalist who has spent more than a decade documenting refugee flows in the Mediterranean. Darren, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank
His
you.
Work is on display now at Duke University's Perkins Library. He is also speaking tonight after a film screening at Duke Smith Warehouse, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.